I'm Adam Rappaport. Welcome to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. Today we are jetting off to Vegas for the Vegas Uncorked by Bon Appetit Food Festival. Just a cavalcade of amazing chefs, awesome eating and drinking, hanging out at the pool, gambling, golfing. You know, basically everything that is awesome about Vegas, where we sat down with, I think, not only one of the world's most famous chefs, but I think you could easily say the most volatile chef on the planet. And I think I mean that in a good way. But first, I am joined in studio now by one of my personal food world heroes, Ina Garten.
It's so nice to be here. It's so nice to see you.
I am like totally, as the kids would say, fanning out right now.
Thank you.
So a lot of things I want to talk to you about. I mean, like you got a new book out, Make It Ahead. It is your 9th book, correct?
It is.
And from what I've read, I researched that you've sold 6 million books. Is that correct?
I think it's, I'm not sure. I think
our publisher says 10 million.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
You've been on TV since the early 2000s?
2002.
Yeah. Good Lord. You've contributed to magazines, Martha Stewart.
Exactly. And now Food Network Magazine.
Food Network Magazine. Yeah. If we can start off with TV, because I think it's probably the way most people have sort of accessed you in America, just in terms of numbers, probably.
Well, I think the depth of the audience is extraordinary in TV, and also because you're like in people's living rooms.
Yeah.
They feel like they know you, so it's a really wonderful medium.
No, I guess my question is, so you started in 2002. You had had a shop, The Barefoot Contestant, in East Hampton.
Yeah.
You wrote your first cookbook. What made you think that, oh, yeah, I'd be good on TV. I can do this.
Oh, I so didn't think that. Actually, Food Network, I'd written maybe 2 books at that time, and Food Network came to me and said, we'd love you to do a show. And I said, absolutely not, because I couldn't imagine that I could do it. And they kept coming back every 6 months. They'd make me a better offer. I'm like, I'm not negotiating.
Yeah.
I just don't want to do it.
What? Why do you think they thought you would be good?
It was the moment at Food Network, I'm sure you remember this, where all the chefs with big toques were making like 6 different kinds of mousse layered on top of each other. And there's one woman at Food Network, Eileen Opetut, along with Bob Tushman, who's still there, decided that what they wanted to do is have home cooks.
Yeah.
And so they went out and found Rachel Ray, Paula Deen, Jada De Laurentiis, and me, and decided to shift gears in the station. But I just didn't imagine that I could do this.
Yeah.
And so I just, for several years, I actually said no. And finally, someone saw a show in Australia and said, you should watch this show, because if you wanted to do a TV show, it would look like this. And I asked them to get Food Network to get me a copy of the show. It was Nigella's show.
Oh, wow.
Nigella Lawson from London. And I looked at it. I thought, well, that's a gorgeous show. It's a very lifestyle. It's very beautiful. Food is interesting. And but, I mean, I'm not Nigella, so I couldn't imagine doing it. And so I said no. And then I said, thank you very much, but I still don't want to do it. They went to London, found the producer, hired them, called me on the phone, and said, they're coming to your house in 2 weeks. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I said I wouldn't do it. They said, just do 13 shows. And I thought, okay, I'll do 13 shows, and then they'll never call me again. Happily, that was 13 years ago.
I think you need to write a self-help book called The Power of No. It's amazing.
It is actually amazing. It's amazing.
Do you remember when you started recording, at what point did you say to yourself, I can do this? Like, what point did it click? Like, oh, wait a minute,
You're assuming I've said that.
You said that. Come on. You must feel that way.
I really don't get it. I mean, honestly, it's not modesty. I just don't get it. I just do what I do, and it just seems to work, and I'm not quite sure why. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, when the first show we did, I always remember this, and I thought, oh, my God, this is just so awful. And then when I saw it edited and put together and with beautifully lit and the food looked great, I thought, that's actually not as bad as I feared.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said to my director at the time, that, you know, it's just like, if this is okay, it's going to just get better. And she said, not necessarily.
Really?
She said, that nervous energy really works on TV.
Yeah.
And that you're there and you're up and you're energized. And I don't think I've ever lost that nervous energy.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Because it's, the medium, just talking to a camera is scary.
Yeah. And I would say that in terms of Nigella's production team, it's just what I always love about the show when I watch it, like, I'm watching you make chicken salad or something, and you're mincing the celery, and it's like shunk, shunk,
well, that's
shunk.
A very important part of it is the sound.
Oh, my God, so
and the
good.
Sound guy's fantastic. But my director is the guy who kind of invented that, what everybody now calls food porn.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the one who invented that, where you hear the eggshell hitting the sink.
Yeah, I feel like when you're frying chicken, I feel like I'm in the pan chicken.
Well, one of the things that we did was we designed the show so that it felt like you were hanging out on the other side of the counter.
Whose idea was it to sort of bring your actual real-life friends into the show in terms of at the end, like, hey, my friend so-and-so is stopping by?
That's the only reason why I'm doing it, because the producers really got that. You can't make this stuff up. It has to be real. And it's why it's in my actual house. It's why they're my actual friends. It's why we actually have a party. When we have a party at the end, I always say to the director, please, just let us have a party. Film it. If you need some details later, we'll go back.
Yeah.
But you can't fake it.
It's also interesting that the friends punctuate the point that cooking is, you cook for people.
That's the only right. That's why I do it. I don't cook for myself.
Yeah.
I cook because when you cook, everybody shows up. And to me, that's the best part of it.
Now, how often, is it tough for you socially that you have friends who are like, oh my God, Ina hasn't, she's never asked me on the show. I don't know. Did I do something wrong? Like,
oh, I don't know. Now I'm going to look at that.
How competitive do your friends get? They must get competitive.
Well, I always feel like I'm imposing on them. And certainly in the beginning, I was really shy about saying, would you mind? Would it be okay if you didn't? And then I realized they were like, I haven't been on the show in a while. Is there a problem?
Exactly,
I'm like, no, you can do it. So I think I've come around to that people actually want to.
Yeah, yeah.
So
do you realize like what a broad appeal you have in the sense that I was just talking to my assistant, Emma, who you met just now. Emma's 22, and she's like, oh, my God, I love Ina. She has a special place in my heart. She's the reason I got into cooking.
Isn't that one? That's, to me, the best.
Yeah, I'm 45. I watch you all the time. My mom's 80. She watches you. I mean, that's kind of
isn't
incredible.
That extraordinary?
You go, I mean, I literally know hip kids on my staff from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, who love Ina. You know, it's interesting. You have that appeal. Have you sort of thought about that?
I have thought about it because I think it's amazing. And it's also broad economically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember walking up Madison Avenue and there was a woman in a big fur coat and she goes, oh, darling, love your cookbooks. And I was like, thank you. And about a block later, a guy with a jackhammer working on the street.
No way, really?
Goes, hey, babe, love your show. And I thought, this is what food is about.
Yeah, what brings
and
people together?
But everybody's interested in food. And I absolutely adore the young people. I think a lot because of Food Network. They grew up watching Food Network.
Interesting.
And boys.
Yeah.
I just love that boys watch. Bobby Flay and Michael Simon and all those guys and Mario Batali really got boys into cooking. It was all of a sudden cool to do. And so I absolutely love that the new generation is cooking. They're entertaining. They're at home. They have kids. They're into farm-grown produce.
All that good stuff. Yeah.
All the good stuff. They're really focused on that, and I think it's a real regeneration of food,
yeah,
which is great.
I think it's interesting, just in terms of generationally, but also gender-wise. I think your food is not. It's not pretentious or whatever. It's like, hey, it's mac and cheese and it's fried chicken. By the way, I use your mac and cheese recipe religiously for the last 10 years. You know, I think it's interesting that, this is how it sort of touches all those notes.
I'm always looking for remembered flavors, things that you remember, chicken stew or chicken pot pie, but that there's a tweak in it. There's something that really turns up the volume and the flavor. So it's better than you remember, but it's the same thing.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking about that, looking at your new book, Make It Ahead, in terms of, I think that's something that we always preach or try to preach in the magazine. And entertaining is stressful enough, and the last thing you want to do is have that last-minute food disaster.
And the irony of my professional careers. I mean, I had a specialty food store, so I've certainly cooked more than most people, but I'm not a professional chef. And so it's, I understand how hard it is.
Yeah.
Because it's hard for me. And if it's stressful for me, I can imagine somebody who's, got a regular job and comes home and tries to make dinner for their family or wants to make a dinner party on Saturday night. I really understand. So I try and make it as simple as I can with still having like the really good flavor.
Yeah. So I guess that's the question. When you're developing recipes, and are there guidelines that you follow, like, oh, this is an Ina recipe, this isn't, because so-and-so, like what qualifies, what doesn't qualify?
Well, the first thing I look for is it a subject, something I want to eat? Is it chicken or is it like octopus eyeballs?
Yeah.
You'll never find anything. I mean, even something like liver is a very particular flavor,
yeah.
So you'll never find that in my books. Maybe like, chicken liver mousse or something, which is actually in this. It has to be familiar in some way. So you're going to turn the page, look at the photograph, photograph and go, that looks delicious and I want to eat it. So that's the first thing. And then is the recipe simple enough to do that I don't, you know, I don't get bored with the recipe while I'm making it.
Yeah.
And then I test it over and over and over and over. And I take somebody to the grocery store and watch them shop for the recipe.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating.
So I see, you know, how hard is it? So first, I gave somebody a recipe for pesto who wanted to learn how to cook. And the first ingredient was basil. And he had no idea whether it was fresh basil or dry basil.
Oh, so you're really
and from that
say
moment
fresh
on,
basil.
I always write fresh basil.
That's fascinating.
So, and olive oil. You know, he picked out 8 ounces of olive oil and he needed 2 cups. I knew he was in trouble when he got home.
Yeah.
So I try and get rid of all those sort of kinks that people don't know. So if you already know 8 ounces, you know what it is, you're just going to read over it. But if you need the information, it's right there.
And I think that's always challenging with here at the magazine. You want something that's familiar, but you want it to be a little new and different.
New.
And
yeah.
But if it's too new and too different, then
exactly. Nobody's going to want to make it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you do entertain, obviously. When was the last time you had a kitchen disaster? When did something not go right?
Well, usually when I'm entertaining, I've made something over and over and over again. And to me, not going right is probably different from what to you not going right. Because I've served things and I'm like, oh, the scallops didn't. It was New Year's Eve actually in Paris, and I made scallops Provençal, and it was the wrong size pan, and the scallops were different, and it didn't have enough sauce, and I was despondent.
Of course, no one even noticed. Probably.
Jerry was like, "That was the best scallops I've ever had. Were you crazy?"
So pan seared scallops, and then
First I saute shallots and herbs and things like garlic and shallots, and then I put the scallops in and sear the scallops, and then put the mixture in. So it happens really fast.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just didn't put enough wine in, so. And it evaporated too quickly.
Oh.
So, but that's cooking. I mean, that's
that
what happens.
But it's interesting you brought up the point about the size of a pan. A 10-inch pan is going to affect a recipe differently than an 8-inch pan in terms of when the liquid evaporates or how much heat it attracts. And that sort of stuff, it's hard to explain that in a recipe. And at some point, you just need to trust your instinct. Right?
I was actually making it for my friends. You may know them, George German and Joanne Killeen from Al Forno Restaurant. And George was standing in the kitchen watching me sear these scallops and didn't say a word. And they just wasn't happening. And I said, George, what am I doing wrong? And he said, they're too close together.
Yeah.
And that was just a great lesson for me because I was making a double recipe. And what I should have done is make two pans.
Two pans, yeah. Because so, if you want them to caramel, otherwise they're steaming as opposed to caramelizing.
Exactly, exactly.
But that's also interesting. That's something,
that was a great lesson for me.
As you point out, that's something that a professional chef knows almost intuitively. The home cook, though, that is not something they necessarily know.
Exactly.
And they have to sort of be told.
And I never forgot it.
How often do you actually, do you follow recipes or do you kind of just?
To the letter.
To the letter.
I absolutely, exactly. Salt, pepper, everything.
Wow.
I measure everything. So I'm really a scientist about it.
All right. So when you're hosting, what should a guest bring? What's a good gift for a guest to bring? What do you like?
When I'm going to somebody's house, actually, I try not to bring something that they feel that they have to serve.
Yeah, that drives me nuts.
Because, you know, I've got a dessert. They've got a dessert. Which one do I serve? Maybe it's not that great.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't go with the meal. Who knows what it is? What I try and do is bring something that they can have the next day, like something for breakfast.
That's cool.
You know, some great coffee or homemade granola.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, you can always bring chocolates because, you know, everybody needs chocolates after dinner.
They're going to get eaten.
But it's never something that's in the meal.
Yeah.
So the hostess doesn't go, oh.
Doesn't feel pressure.
And even like wine. If you bring wine, the hostess always wants to know, or the host, should I serve it? Should I not serve it? So if I'm bringing wine, maybe I'll bring white wine that's not chilled so
they know
it's not for dinner.
As a host, what's a good go-to sort of last-minute hors d'oeuvre? Hors d'oeuvres are something that I think everyone thinks about the main course and dessert, but then they're like, oh, I need something to serve during cocktails.
I actually almost never make something for hors d'oeuvres. What I do is I pull together things that are already prepared, salted Marcona almonds, you know, things that are just good as is, maybe some, you know, in the summer melon with a little prosciutto wrapped around it, just really simple cherry tomatoes from the farm stand, just really simple things that you can eat. So you can spend as much time making orders as you do dinner, and nobody really appreciates it. So it's like crazy.
But it's also, I think it's a good message that not everything needs to be homemade and labored over, you know, when you come over.
My mantra is, are your friends going to have more fun if you've served this? And the truth is, it doesn't matter. And the most important thing for a good party is the hostess is like sweating and crying and like and going, oh my God, the chicken's never going to be ready and the wine's never going to be cool. Nobody's going to have a good time.
Yeah. I want to get back to the power of no. And you're talking about saying no to the TV show.
I don't understand it, so I don't know how much I can talk about
it. You've also, over the years, you know, you have not done a a product line on HSN or JCPenney or somewhere. You know, you've not launched your own magazine like Rachel Ray or Martha. Like, I'm sure you've been offered. Why not?
So many opportunities to do stuff. I love my life. Mm-hmm. I love doing what I'm doing. And I like doing it really well. And I like very hands-on. And I think if I did too much, I would lose that control of it. And so I just think, why?
In terms of social media, that's something you've gotten into.
Yeah.
And do you enjoy Twitter and Instagram?
No, I was the last one to to all of it. And I have to credit my publisher. They just said, you really have to do it. And I'm like, I don't have time for this. It is so interesting. I have this philosophy that you can't talk about the pond until you're in it and wet.
No.
And so I kept saying, oh, social media, it's not who I am. I'm not doing it. But then finally I said, okay, I have to jump in the pond. I'm going to do it for a year. If it's not interesting, I'll just get out. It is so interesting. The feedback that I get from people is so informs what I do.
Yeah.
And I actually, about a year later, hired someone just to do social media who we adore. And she said to me when she got there, you really need to do Instagram. Like, I already have enough to do.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, again, I said, okay, let's just try. She said, I'm just going to show you a week of Instagram. And then, you know, we'll go from there. And I love it. I just, like, the first thing I look at every morning when I wake up.
It's like you
I
get
just
addicted
love
and...
Instagram. I love doing it. Like, next week I'm going to France, and I'm just, every day I'll do a little Instagram story about where I am and what I'm doing. And it really makes me look at things.
Mm-hmm.
Because it not only has to be interesting, but it has to be a great photograph.
Yeah.
And so, and I love that visual part of it. So, I love Instagram. So, yes, it's been incredible for me, but it's also great for my business
because
it connects with young people. I think that has a lot to do with the success of this book.
I think they're, and they feel that there's a genuine access into your life and not necessarily a produced sort
and
of
it's
way.
True.
Do you realize, all right, final question in terms, before we get to our lightning round, there's going to be a lightning
Uh-oh.
Round. do you realize there's like a whole cult of Jeffrey, right? That people are obsessed with
isn't
Jeffrey.
Isn't that just great?
He's like the mystery man.
And he's the real deal. I mean, on the show, I just think he's amazing. He's such a good sport because he always plays this really funny role, but you know he's really smart.
Well,
he was Undersecretary of Commerce, and he was the head of he was the dean of the business school at Yale. And he's the best business advisor anybody could ever dream of.
That's a good, Good,
but he's
good
just a
that.
Doll.
So, obviously, you must get, as you mentioned before, get recognized everywhere you go. And does Jeffrey get recognized a lot? Do people like, wait a minute, you're Jeffrey?
All the time. And, I mean, going through the airport in London and the guy checking your luggage goes, you're Jeffrey, you've gotten me in trouble. And I'm like, why? I remember this guy said, because my wife always says to me, why don't you like what I make the way Jeffrey likes what Ina makes?
That is too funny.
He does get recognized a lot.
All right, we are going to hit you with some lightning round questions.
Yeah, okay.
There's no wrong answer, but you do have to answer.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to hit you with some quick ones. And we're getting on summer, so some of these are kind of summer themed.
This is like inside the actor studio.
Exactly.
What's your favorite swear word?
Exactly. Gas or charcoal?
Oh, charcoal.
Without question.
Easy.
Margarita or mimosa?
Margarita.
I assume you make them yourself.
Oh, totally make them myself because very few places, and I like the places that do use fresh lime juice.
All right, this is a tough one. Food TV, Jacques or Julia?
Oh, that's really tough.
Yeah,
you got to pick one. Well, Julia taught me how to cook, so I have to pick Julia, but I adore Jacques.
He is like the most charming guy ever.
Charming. His food. See, here's a guy who had the most famous restaurant in New York, and his food is very at home.
Yeah.
You know, it's the food you'd want to make.
And
I really admire him.
Entertaining. Deviled eggs or pigs in a blanket?
Oh, that's a really tough one. deviled eggs. I have to say pigs in blankets. The first time I served them at a party, maybe about 3 or 4 years ago, I served them. Jeffrey took me aside and he goes, you're not. I said, yeah. And he goes, you're not serving pigs in blankets at a party. It's the only time in 46 years he's ever said that to me. I said, watch, it's going to be the first thing gone.
Everything was gone. You cannot serve enough of them. I also love how good the house smells when you have pigs in the blanket in the oven. Everyone's like,
really
wait, are you making pigs in blankets? They just descend on them. Okay, it's summer in the Hamptons. Peonies or sunflowers?
I love peonies. My favorite flower. I think it's everybody's favorite flower, so definitely peonies.
Cast iron or stainless?
I can't answer both, right?
No. You get one. You can have one, one pan.
Well, most of what I do is in all clad.
Okay.
But I do like an ice cast iron pot.
I'm going to take both because I don't have to answer. Cocktail sauce or mignonette?
Cocktail sauce, but a good one.
A good one, yeah. A lot of horseradish.
Yeah.
Sunday supper or Sunday brunch?
I don't love the word brunch. I have no idea why. What I like is Sunday lunch.
Ooh,
I think it's the best time to entertain.
Nice. So what time, if you're having Sunday lunch, what time do you ask your guests
12:30
to arrive?
12:30 or 1. Mm-hmm. And it's something in between. I like to make a frittata and get a smoked salmon platter and big fresh fruit platter and maybe some coffee cake. It's really easy to put together. Everybody shows up at 12:30 or 1. We have a great time.
And they've already had breakfast and stuff.
They've had breakfast. They've done everything on Saturday they had to do. And then, you know, people go antiquing or just something in the afternoon. So it's a really great, like, 2 hours, and everybody's off on their way. So you don't feel like it's like, oh, my God, it's 11 o'clock. I really want to go to bed.
Yeah.
And, it's rude to leave too early.
Or like Sunday brunch. If you're having brunch at 11, then it's always the question of like, well, do I
eat before
I go?
Yeah.
Because if I have to wait till 11, I'm going to be passing out by the time I get to the door.
Exactly.
I've been up since 7 with my kid or whatever.
So, yeah, Sunday lunch is actually my all-time favorite.
You've got one vacation, France or Italy?
Yeah, well, that's easy.
Really?
France.
Last question, olive oil or butter? You can only choose one for the rest of your life. What's it going to be?
It's got to be butter.
It's got to be. Ina Garten, thank you so much for joining us on the Bon Appetit Foodcast.
It was so much fun to talk to you. Thanks, Adam.
Welcome back to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. A few weeks ago, a bunch of us editors flew out to Las Vegas for our annual Vegas Uncorked Food Festival, and Andrew Knowlton, our restaurant editor, and I had the chance to sit down with Chef Gordon Ramsay. Here you go. Gordon, thanks for having us here, man.
Good to see you guys, and what a night last night.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm feeling it right now.
Oh, man.
Gordon would be referring to the Calvin Harris concert at the Omnia nightclub. Apparently, what time did you leave there?
Literally 10 minutes ago.
Yes.
We went from the party to the pool party and then back for lunch. No, I think we got out there about 4:30, I think, this morning.
All right, so speaking about being up late, and here you are at 6 p.m., we are coming from your restaurant here at Caesar's Palace. You know, I'm sitting next to you two guys. Both of you travel a lot for work. Andrew's reviewing restaurants left and right. Andrew, you look like you weigh about 140. Gordon, you look like you kick my ass in a second. Seriously, how do the two of you stay so fit? And don't act like, oh, I just whatever. Like, I know you guys both work at it. Gordon, like, how do you do what you do? Because the amount you travel, the amount you eat, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I go through phases. So we've been in production since January. I've been back to...
For MasterChef.
Yeah, for MasterChef Junior. I've been back and forth every 3 weeks. 3 weeks on, 1 week off. So honestly, I've done nothing in the last 2 months, but I know I've got a big training schedule coming up in the next sort of 6 weeks. So I'll have a blast and drop 15, 18 pounds, and then whilst in production, I'll put another 15 or 20 back on.
Wait, so when you say have a blast, you mean that means like working out?
Yeah, like train. Yeah, no, train. But even swimming.
Yeah.
Swimming first thing in the morning, and then running and cycling at the weekend. So, yeah, I'll start all that stuff next week.
If I may, how tall are you and how much do you weigh? And when you're at your peak weight, what is it?
Yeah, 6'2 and about 205 pounds.
Wow, you could kick my ass.
But it's interesting what he says. Like, if I went to a dietitian, they would say I have an eating disorder because I binge eat.
Yeah.
And then
I just want to say, but binge eating, Andrew travels around the country for Bon Appetit, checking out the best restaurants in the country, and he'll eat a health 3 dinners in one night, and the next day, breakfast.
And then, you know, but I always try to run when I'm on the road. Like, I try to stay strategically at hotels that are near a running path or whatnot.
Yeah.
And then when I get back, when I'm just writing and not having to eat, I juice for I will do juice cleanses for a week.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I changed about 18 months ago from flat to sparkling. Water, no, because it fills me up. And so I have, I eat less, but I taste more. So I can drop it after a mouthful. And that was fundamental. So
Wait. The difference between flat and sparkling, explain that.
So flat water, there's no gas, obviously. Sparkling, there's obviously bubbles. So you get aerated a lot fuller quicker. Yeah. So I changed that. And that switch, for me, transformed the way I eat.
Oh, wow.
So I'll taste now, as opposed to completing a dish, so much better and more disciplined.
So, all right, so to explain to the listener, so... You record MasterChef in Los Angeles.
Yes.
You live in London with your wife and 4 children.
That's right.
Correct. Which that in alone is a full-time job. But yeah, so when you're recording, explain to the average person who does not work in TV, like, that you're not just going to shoot for an hour or two a day. All day, every day, right?
You know, it's a full-on production. And MasterChef is sort of pre-shot as well. So you see the different angles. So we shoot it twice. So we'll do a pre-shoot without the chefs, and then we'll shoot live to tape. So we've got every angle, every little moment covered. And so we start, average, we're on set for 5. We'll start rolling at 6, 6.15, and we'll be there.
In the morning?
Yes, 3 till 9, 9.30. Home, 10, 10.30. I'll make an hour, 90 minutes call in the UK, which of course is the following morning. Yeah. So I'll get everybody on the way to work, do the school run in terms of FaceTime and transit. So I do my my school runs. May not be there in person, but I'll FaceTime them on a school run.
And how many days a week are you shooting?
6.
All right, that's insane. How do you not just end up feeling like crap all the time during those sort of intense days? Mm-hmm. Like, does your body feel like, ugh? Or do you find a way to sort of keep energized throughout mm-hmm. the day somehow?
No, you do. You do feel like crap. Yeah. You do feel, and also you feel like you've overeaten, and you get sick of it.
Yeah.
You know, 25 to 30 contestants at the beginning, you know, we don't go down, you know, 10 guests a week. It's, you know, we eliminate one at a time. So we'll literally do a mystery box challenge, and we'll have to taste, you know, for standards and practice, to be fair, and judge properly across the board. We'll taste 25 dishes, and you feel like crap after it.
How often do you think, like, why am I doing this? Why don't I just pull back a little and have uh-huh. a little bit more of a life,
yeah.
you know?
You know, I the production works around me. So with my own production company, we get that kind of freedom. So the diary's planned for literally 50 months in advance. So it is full on. But I know now, from literally Tuesday night, we wrap the finale. I'll be on the 9.30 flight. I call it the bus.
The bus.
And I'll take a glass of wine. I'll wake up in London. We won't be taping for another 6 months. So I'll go at it full on. Bank it, you know, get into the edits, fine-tune it, voiceovers, and then, you know, wait for the next startup next year.
Wow. So sometimes you're describing your schedule. Do you sometimes now kind of pinch yourself, like when you were just a student of cooking?
I mean, it's
pretty incredible, like, you know, the rise of Gordon Ramsay. It's amazing.
I mean, there's sacrifice. You know, yeah. you've got to work at it. That's you know that. So, I don't know. I think, you know, somebody asked me at Atlantic City last weekend, you know, do you miss cooking? I said, no, I haven't stopped cooking. We still wouldn't be where we are today if I just sort of, hey, I'm a TV chef. I get called a TV chef because I'm on TV a lot, but I am a real chef and I do work extremely hard behind the scenes. So,
yeah, one thing interesting, we were talking about this off air before about what kind of matters in your life. And Andrew and I both have kids. I have a 7-year-old. You have 2 daughters. What ages?
6 and 3.
MasterChef Junior, which has become a...
my favorite show, by the way, of what you
yeah,
do.
A yeah, a huge hit. Did you anticipate it being a hit? And how did that show come about, because of your children? Or who hatched that idea? And what's the background?
It was one of my first ever programs I judged. I got asked by a guy called Lloyd Grossman, an amazing presenter, a South African foodie. He started off as a food critic for the Sunday Times. And he asked me to judge at MasterChef Junior in the UK. I was so excited. So, ironically, it was the first major thing I filmed back in the UK. So when we started talking about it here, it was almost... so much more appealing for me than a celebrity version of that MasterChef, because in the UK there's MasterChef professionals, celebrity MasterChef, junior MasterChef, MasterChef adults.
Wow.
It's just too many. So when they started talking about a celebrity version, I don't like that stuff.
Right. And I just think it's amazing. That's one of the one shows of culinary speaking that I watch on TV, probably because I have kids, but it's just amazing to see, you know, especially in the US, like, this whole food revolution that we're going through is not that recent. Like,
no.
20 years ago, we wouldn't be eating what we are now. And to see these kids and their knowledge of what they're doing, that, and I'm trying to raise kids that have a respect for where their ingredients come from and learn how to cook for themselves, that's got to be rewarding for you.
Yeah, we've got a fascinating scenario this time around where we're having the youngest ones, the 8, 9-year-olds, actually more talented than the late 12, 13-year-olds. There's one young girl that was born in 2007. She's been watching it since she's 4 and grown up with it. But the fascinating thing is that, you know, it's not softball lessons. It's not swimming lessons. You know, they go to cooking lessons. They do online cooking courses. So it's great to see. And then we had this amazing astronaut 3 weeks ago that was helping for one of the challenges. She'd been on the space station several times. Incredible lady. But the kids weren't obsessed with becoming an astronaut because it wasn't that era. And she thought, oh, my God.
They want to be cooks.
That's fascinating. Like people who grew up in the 60s were like, right. you know, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong. Like those guys were...
They got excited about it, but it wasn't what they wanted to do. So yeah, it's been an interesting turnaround this year.
What's interesting with kids also, and I have not done a good job with this as a father, but it's interesting if you get kids young enough, they just learn intuitively. They don't think, like if you get a kid pick up an iPad or something, like 2-year-olds know how to operate.
They know how to work it, yeah.
Better than
yeah.
you do. And
I still think it's a life skill. And you know, I've looked at some of the programs that you have here in the schools in terms of the way they eat. We're now using the kids to educate the parents.
Yeah.
And it's turned on its head. And also I think it's pivotal that, you know, even if you never perfect it as a career, just to graduate and leave home and cook for yourself 3 times a day, one decent meal for the rest of your life, fundamentally important. And we've got all this horrendous pressure about the out of control eating habits, 99 cents meals. You know, it is a life skill of great confidence.
If I may pry a little bit, you're able to give all this attention to the competitors and MasterChef and the kids and whatnot. How do you deal with your own children in terms of food and being a dad and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, you know, good question. I mean, we're honest. Last year, Megan's 16th birthday was the first time ever we'd ever eaten at Royal Hospital Road.
Oh, really?
I just thought it was really important to do. And then at the end of it, bless her, you know, Meg said, Daddy, that was an amazing dinner. I get it. I get you. and I get why.
I like you, Dad.
It's just so we protect because I think Tana and I are in danger of having food snobs.
Of course.
And it was just like, it's easy for them. They can just go eat. They have to pick up a check and all that crap. So you've got to go through the pizzas. They've got to go through the junk food. They've got to go through the fast food, the burgers. And you just put it all in moderation. Here's the good, here's the naughty. This is stuff you can have, but once a month, not every day. And be honest with them.
Right, this food will make you feel good. This food has its consequences.
Yeah, and we started off with teaching them breakfast because it was the first meal of the day, whether it's an oatmeal, porridge, whether it's scrambled eggs or poached eggs, and then they get to lunch, and then eventually they end up cooking dinner.
That's great.
Could I have a question for Andrew?
Sure.
Would you mind?
Yeah.
As a restaurant critic, what's the basis of a good critic? How do you stop it from becoming personal when you know the chef on their second or third restaurant? And I'll come on to another part of that question.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's difficult. There's a lot of people that I wish I was friends with because I'm interested in food and restaurants and I connect with chefs a lot of time, but I have my friendships have suffered because I have to keep my distance from them and I don't wear wigs or anything like that.
No.
I mean, but that's the biggest thing. I think in terms of being a restaurant critic, for me, it's just having an open mind and wanting to try everything. Because if I don't like kidneys, which I don't necessarily like kidneys, I know there's a reader out there that does like kidneys. So I need to try those kidneys. And I just try to go in with no preconceived notions about what I'm eating. It's like, how's the ambiance? How's the food? How's the service? And what is Gordon Ramsay trying to do with this restaurant in Las Vegas, you know, how that appeals to them.
Yeah.
And if I may, as the editor over here, you have to be a good writer. Can you put your thoughts together in an interesting way that people want to read? You can be someone who knows a lot about food, but if you can't write about it interestingly, no one cares. And so can you express your thoughts in an engaging, sort of charismatic, sort of fun way?
Yep.
And just, my feeling is, it's if you're a critic, it's completely subjective. This is what Andrew Knowlton likes. And you have to understand that as a reader.
Absolutely. But isn't it a writing skill then?
It is a writing skill. So, but I also think the reader connects with my voice just like they would with Corin in London or 100%. Any of those guys. But I think the British criticism is much more personal than the American criticism.
That was the second part of the question. Because do you not find it harder to judge a restaurant's second restaurant of that particular chef on equally status as if you've got no background, you don't know, you've never been to a cocktail party.
It has to be challenging because we know
chefs. Of course it is, yes.
And I will say this though, I mean, two things. At Bon Appetit, like we do talk about the best new restaurants in America every September. We name the best new restaurants in America issue. Yes. But we don't review and critique restaurants the way that, say, Pete Wells of the New York Times does. And Pete goes through very extremes, remain very much under the radar, not go to sort of food events, not hobnob with the chefs.
Right, not on TV.
And Pete's a very good writer who writes in a very smart way and tries to be. And so I think in that sense, if you, that's tough. If you're going to really critique people and give them stars and write negatively about them, Andrew essentially will typically recommend the 10 best restaurants, but he's not going to slam people.
No.
And so
I'm not into that. That's not interesting. To me.
Yeah.
No, I want to celebrate what's good and the other stuff will work itself out. If a restaurant's not good, the public can decide that.
That's gracious. Can a restaurant critic perform on TV?
Absolutely. I think so. I mean, the notion of anonymity is done. It's always been that way in London.
Yeah.
They're all on TV.
But in this in this digital social media age, I don't think there's anything such as anonymity. Doesn't really exist.
But Gordon, how much from your perspective do you? I mean, it's kind of we work together in a certain way, chefs and critics or media. But I assume that you want criticism in your field because that keeps you on your toes, or it's like being an artist or a musician. Like, you need that criticism, right?
I think that's fundamentally important. I always get criticized for, following the Michelin guide, but we don't know them.
Right.
They don't come to launch parties. They're not at book fairs.
Right.
They don't come to my house for dinner. So it's incognito.
Right.
Of course, we'll see it with a final inspection for a 3-star.
Right.
But I suppose I love that distance, and that's something that's not healthy in the UK. But
as someone who creates something, whether you're a chef or a restaurant critic or a musician or some other sort of writer, it's about maintaining and being true to your take on something. Like, you as a chef have a point of view. He is a writer. And
yes.
If I'm going to read Jonathan Gold's reviews in the Los Angeles Times because I like the way Jonathan Gold writes. And they're entertaining. And it's like he has a voice that only he has. And
yes.
So regardless of, there could be 26 other people who wrote about that restaurant already. Mm-hmm. But when Jonathan's review comes out, I want to hear what he has to say.
His voice.
Yeah. And that's what it comes down to. And I could go to the same thing with the musician or whatnot or a chef. It's like, I want to know what Gordon's doing. I want to know what Prince is, how he's going to record this song.
Yeah. We're a lot more incestuous in the UK. My final point, we had Giles Curran review my restaurant years ago, Royal Hospital Road. Didn't like it. Got incredibly drunk and then phoned the following day for a rundown of what he'd eaten. I gave him the rundown and the we got panned.
I would never do that.
No,
I suppose. That to me, but that's like, who's the other writer who writes for Vanity Fair?
A. Gill.
Gill. Yeah. Like, some of his writing is just like, I think he compared something to, it tasted like sperm inside of a condom or something.
Yeah.
There was a famous review of...
Yeah, well, probably my restaurant. Hence the reason why I kicked him out as well. But the other issue also, there was a Faye Mashler wrote about my first restaurant when the foam thing was going on crazy in the 90s. It's still going now. And it said, God, this dish looked like toxic scum on a stagnant pool. And I'm like reading that, I'm thinking, Jesus Christ.
But you remember the line.
I do. But I've never used it over one of the dishes. And it's like, you guys are damning, man.
I think you have to separate. It can't be personal. It has to just, you're going in there as a belly and a mouth, and you're eating a food mm-hmm. and ingesting it just like the public would. And if I don't like Gordon Ramsay and I go into a restaurant, like, what service is that to the reader? Because I'm representing the reader, the average consumer who's coming into a restaurant. And I might have a, quote unquote, better palate than them, or I might like sweetbreads and they don't, but mm-hmm. I'm judging you about what you're trying to do at a restaurant. And like, whether I like you or not has nothing to do with the meal that I'm served.
Yeah, and this is amazing dialogue, by the way, but one final question. Sorry, it will be the final one. You describe food brilliantly.
Thank
with
you.
Authenticity, clearly that's there. Do you think you could ever cook it as good as you describe it?
That's a good question. I mean, I did cook in a restaurant for a while. I have some skills, I think, in the kitchen. Nothing that approaches Ramsay level. But no, I...
But you go in depth in a way that is the character.
You could argue if he worked at it.
If you do then get to cook it as well as you describe it, I'm fucked.
Yeah, well, thank you.
So just continue writing, please.
All right, Gordon Ramsay, congratulations. You are the new host of the Bon Appetit Foodcast. Thank you for having us. I'm Adam Rappaport. That's Andrew Dalton. That's Gordon Ramsay.
Thanks, guys.
Gordon. The Bon Appetit Foodcast is recorded to a digital device in the small conference room on the 36th floor of One World Trade Center in New York City. Our engineer is Mitra Kaboli, with production assistance from Bill Cushing and Kerry Polis, and is produced by Scott DeSimon. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or at bonappetit.com.